Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Tonight I'd like to talk about perception, which is one of the aspects of the mind, in the way that the Buddha described a human being. A human being is constituted of mind and body, and the mind has different functions, different aspects, and the mind arises through contact, through the sense doors, through the eye door and what we see, through the ear door and what we hear, through the nose door and what we smell, through the tongue door and what we taste, and through the body door and what we feel through touch. And every time we come in contact with something, that is, we see something or we hear something, etc., then the mind arises in a process of cause and effect. And the aspects of the mind, consciousness, that is the seeing or the hearing, the smelling, the tasting, the touching, gives rise to Vedana, which is the Pali word which describes whether the experience is pleasant, unpleasant, or neither unpleasant nor unpleasant, more neutral. The sanya, the perception, is that aspect of the mind which makes sense of what it is that we have contacted, what that sight is, what that sound is, what that smell is, what that taste is, what that touch is. And then from making sense of that experience comes our reaction to it, which is called the sankhara in Pali. And that's where we make a reaction, a decision. We act according to whether it's been pleasant or unpleasant, whether we want it, we want to get it again, we want to have more of it, we like it or not. Then our actions follow. First of all, our mental reactions, and then our speech and our behaviour. And this is just to give you an outline of the way the Buddha described you and me. That is, everyone is made up of these five aggregates, the five khandhas, the body, and then the four aggregates of mind. And tonight I'd particularly like to talk about perception, sanya. And in the meditation that we've just done, we've had an illustration of the way that perception works. When I asked you to look on the breath as a life-giving exchange of energy, it was putting a particular slant on the breath. Very often we don't even notice that we're breathing. It's something that's just done automatically, and we can take it for granted. We can think it's boring to watch the breath, because our perception, our way of thinking of that breath, is that it's just something that's always been there. What's so special about that? But when we change our idea about the breath, our perception of the breath, to be something that's really significant for our life to continue, when we start to colour it differently, this is something that is essential for life. And it's something that is part of my relationship with the world that I live in. It's not just a one-way energy, it's a two-way. I'm receiving something and I'm giving something back. There's this connection. Then all of these ways of describing the breath affects the way that we perceive the breath. We might then perceive the breath as something extraordinary, something special, something that's really important for us to survive. Or we might like the fact that it signifies our interconnection with other life forms. We like the idea of being in a relationship with the world around us, an essential relationship. If the trees don't produce the oxygen, then there's nothing for us to live on. Even if we've got food and water, we can't survive. And so that might help us to get more interest in the breath, to soften our attitude towards the breath, to no longer think of it as boring. And if we start to appreciate the breath and we get more interest in the breath, then it becomes much easier to watch the breath. One of the most basic meditations for calming the mind is to watch the breath. And yet it's very difficult to do. It's a very straightforward and simple meditation object, a meditation practice, and it takes us all the way through calm to insight. And it's the meditation practice that the Buddha used and that he praised, and yet it's very difficult to master it. And one of the reasons that it's very difficult to master it is because the breath is not interesting enough for the mind to really stay with. It doesn't have enough colour to it. It doesn't have enough taste to it for the mind to be really interested in it, to the exclusion of anything else that might pop into the mind. And so changing our perception of the breath, the way that we view the breath, the way that we feel about the breath, is a way of helping us to stay focused on the breath and to move through the beginning stages of meditation to start to uncover the joy and the happiness, the peace and the calm that's possible when the meditation starts to develop. It's a fact that the more interested we are in something, the more positive we are about something, the easier it is for us to be interested in it, to stay with it, and to find its specialness. The things that we don't like, the things that we do think are boring, the mind very easily slips off, slips away from. The mind actually goes looking for something that's not boring, that's more pleasant, that gives something more fulfilling. And so it's very useful if we want to progress in our meditation to endow the breath with these special qualities. And they aren't special in the fact that we're making them up, because when we stop to think about it, we really are dependent on the next breath in for life to continue. We really are dependent on the oxygen being there to keep this body alive. And so if we can slightly change our attitude through the way that we perceive the breath, then we have a much better chance of being able to stay focusing on it moment after moment and to hold it very tenderly, not to put too much force into the watching the breath, not trying to manipulate the breath, but just allowing it to be natural, just appreciating it as it is. This playing around with perception around the breath helps us to understand a little better what perception is and how it affects us in our daily life. Just the fact that we are manipulating perception in this way, planting seeds in the mind, changing our attitude, is an indication of what sanya perception is like in the way that it arises moment by moment in our ordinary consciousness. That is, it's affected by what we've put into the mind, our previous experience, the things we've been taught, our attitudes, our inclinations are in the sanya before we've decided consciously what this thing is or whether we like it or not. The sanya is already arising, coloured by various conditioning. I had a very interesting example of this when I was down here last time. I was going on alms round on Saturday morning in the community hall. Those of you who are familiar with Saturdays and Sundays here at the Buddhist Centre, at 10:30 the monks and nuns, usually just me, one nun, are offered our daily food in the community hall by various people who bring the alms food at that time. And the monks go first with their alms bowl, and I follow behind with my alms bowl. And this time I was following as usual behind the two bhikkhus, and I passed a little girl who put some rice in the bowl. And as I passed by, she said to her father, "Is that a girl one, Daddy?" A girl one. It was the first time she'd seen a nun. Now, this is a very good example of sanya perception, because not having seen a nun before, she could see the similarities between nuns and monks. She didn't know the word nun, but she knew that there was a similarity between those ones, the boy ones, and this one, the girl one. She saw the similarities, but she also saw the differences, because she had some experience of boys and girls. So she somehow worked out that this was like that one, the boys, but was different. It was like the girls. Now, we all wear the same kind of robes, different colours. We all have our head shaven and not wearing jewellery or makeup. So how did she distinguish the boy ones from the girl ones? But she did. Maybe it was that I didn't have a beard or a shadow of having shaven my face. Or maybe it was the way I moved, or maybe it was the way I smelled. When she came up to speak to me afterwards, I asked her to look at the boys, the boy ones and the girl ones, and see what she could see was the same and what was different. And what we came up with was that I was wearing one of these, a sleeve, had something on my arm, and the boys didn't. So trying to backtrack to see how she had distinguished monks from nuns was interesting, because she didn't consciously know how she'd done it either. And this is what happens in experience every day. We don't know how we know what we know, and we don't know why it is that we're reacting the way we're reacting. But what we've learnt previously, what we've experienced previously, is giving us cues about what this is like that's the same or similar or different based on previous experience. And when she came to speak with me, it was a very good example also of Vedana, the feeling of pleasant, unpleasant or neutral in any experience. Because when she came to speak with me, she was very at ease, very happy to talk. And she obviously had previously had some contact with the monks and she felt quite comfortable speaking to them. She felt it was quite okay to come and have a chat and to ask some questions. She was only 4 years old. But obviously she wasn't frightened. She was quite upfront. She wanted to know if I was called a monk, and I said, no, I'm called a nun, and she wanted to know what a nun does. And then she told me that she'd like to be a nun. And I said, well, if you want to be a nun, you can become a nun when you're 20. And if you still want to be a nun at 20, then you come and see me. And she said, what do you have to do? And I said, well, you go to school and just keep coming to the temple, and when you're 20, if you're still interested. And she said, good, because I also want to be a ballet dancer and an astronaut. And I said, well, good, then you can going to school until you're 20, it'll be a good choice for any of those careers. So she was very bright and chirpy about the whole thing. But she obviously had, from her previous experience, a positive attitude towards monks and now nuns, because she felt she could come and speak and she wasn't anxious or inhibited in any way. Now, this is a very good example of how the sanya and the vedana go together. What we sense we make of the thing, the object, and the feeling that it gives to us are very much interconnected. And they arise automatically without us even knowing that that's the process that's going on. That what we're seeing now, what we're hearing now, is not the object that we are encountering in this moment. It's that object filtered through our previous experience of it, added onto by our previous experience of it, positively or negatively. This is very important to know because, as I said, that in the way the mind is produced, what comes after our sanya and vedana is our reaction, our speech and our behaviour towards that thing. And we think that it's because of this object, because of this time now, but there's always the past present. The past is in the present and conditioning the present. And that's why we can see the same thing or hear the same thing and we all have a different reaction to it. We all feel differently about it. And we don't even realize that until we compare notes. A very good example of this recently, there was an article in the newspaper about the nuns' monastery, and someone was commenting that they'd read that article. And I said it was very interesting the way that the reporter who came to write the article spent a couple of hours at the monastery. And of course, when the article came into the newspaper, it was just a real snippet of that whole conversation that we had over 2 hours, and very interesting how he picked out certain points in the to write in the article. And one of the points he made was that that it was quite a hard life, quite a difficult life, and living in the bush presented a few challenges, even though it was very nice and peaceful. And that there were some things that were a bit scary, like being in the dark at night without lights and that sort of thing, and spiders and snakes and those sorts of things. Just really the standard of what it's like to live in the bush, nothing special. But anyway, the person who was talking to me about the article made the comment, oh, well, if you go there, you see it's not like that anyway. And they'd been to the monastery once. And it was just very interesting because when they made that comment, three of us heard the comment, and there were three different interpretations of what that person meant by that statement. Oh, if you've been there, you know it's not like that. One person heard, oh, they don't think it's very peaceful. Well, of course, they did come during Dana time when there's lots of people and it's not so peaceful, so that's why they would think that it's not very peaceful. That was what one person heard. Another person heard, oh, they don't think it's very tough at all at the monastery. Well, they should try and live there. It's really tough if they have to walk out in the dark and if they have to be in the cold. And that was what another person heard and how they reacted to what they heard. And another person heard, oh, they think it's really nice at the monastery, and if you spend more time there, you'll find it's even nicer than your first impression. That was what a third person heard. We all heard the same words. We all saw the same person making the same comments. And yet three different reactions arose in the mind of the people who heard it. And not only a different interpretation of what the person said, but also a different feeling about it, which conditions what we think about that person. You wait till they come to the monastery next time. They don't think it's tough here. Well, I'm going to show them. I'm not going to be nice to them. I'm not going to pay any attention to them. Oh, they're such a nice person. They think the monastery's a lovely place. I'll be really pleased to see them next time they come. Now, of course, I'm exaggerating because we're always happy to see everyone who comes to the monastery. But you can see what happens depending on our interpretation. It colours our reaction in the present moment, but it also conditions our reactions next time we see that person. And we only have to see them coming down the steps and we've already decided who they are, what they're like, and we feel our reaction to them without even being consciously aware of it. This is why we get into conflict. This is why we get into arguments, even in a family, even in a group of friends, because we are seeing the same thing, but we're seeing it differently. We're hearing the same thing, but we're hearing it differently, and we're reacting not only this time around, but next time around, according to our own ideas. And we're not even consciously aware that we have them, and we're not aware that that's what's happening. In meditation, what we're trying to do is to become familiar with these different aspects of the mind, to become familiar with how our attitudes towards things affect how well we can pay attention to them. So, for example, our attitude towards the breath. We have this perception of dull and boring breath, and then we can't pay attention to it. The mind always wants something more exciting. And because we aren't aware of that, we wonder why our meditation never develops. But once we have this inkling that the way that we relate to the breath affects our ability to pay attention to the breath, then we can consciously alter, play with our perception of the breath. We can make it into something interesting and delightful, something that we want to pay attention to. And once we see for ourselves the effect that this has, then we understand that we have this capacity to play around with our perceptions in daily life. Our perceptions about this person or that thing can change the way that we deal with it in the moment. Another example was a story someone was telling me of, they were reading of a little girl in this story who lived on a farm, and she loved to feed the ducks, and every morning it was her joy to, from a small age, to run out to feed the ducks and to play with the ducks, until she got to a certain age when her mother told her it was her chore to feed the ducks. Chore to feed the ducks? And that changed her whole attitude. Chore to feed the ducks? Who wants to feed the ducks every day? Do I have to feed them every day? They're so greedy, those ducks. They always want more and more. And just that change of perception, no longer doing something that she loved, meant that she didn't love what she was doing. So the way that we label things, the way that we describe them to ourselves, affects how we relate to that thing. If we describe someone or something in negative terms and we describe it to ourselves again and again, then that sets up a reaction in the mind that comes up automatically, even if it's not helpful, even if it means that our relationship is fractured, is a negative one, is full of irritation, full of resentment, lacking in joy. We don't realize that it's not the relationship or the person, it's our attitude to the thing. It's our attitude to the person. And if we can start to see that in our meditation, the way that our approach affects our ability to stay with the breath, then we start to see how we have the power to do that in our daily life, in those areas of our life which we find problematic, particularly. But when we start to understand the way the mind is conditioned, we can not only apply it to the areas that are problematic, we can apply it to all the areas of our life. One of the little tricks, which you've probably heard Achyam Brahm talk about, is to rise in the morning and look in the mirror and put a smile on your face. And even if a smile doesn't come naturally, to turn up the ends of your mouth so that a smile is there, a forced smile at first. But what a different kind of perception it is when you see someone smiling back at you first thing in the morning. And if you're trying to establish it as a new habit pattern, it's something that you have to do again and again and again until it becomes possible to look in the mirror and to smile automatically, smile naturally. But this is the way we can change the perceptions. The perception about the face in the mirror, but also our perceptions about facing another day. The perception about having to wake up in the morning. The perception about whatever it is that we have to do that day. If we start off with a scowl on our face, then that's going to affect what we do next and what we do next. If we start off with a smile, that's going to affect what we do next, how we feel next. And if we're living with other people, how we relate to other people first thing in the morning. So these perceptions, ways of labeling things, of identifying things, of making sense of things, these are very fundamental to our sense of well-being. And as we see that for ourselves in the meditation on the breath, and as we continue to meditate, the whole process that's taking place moment by moment, at first just in the meditation itself, becomes more obvious. The mind starts to slow down. We start to be able to see the contact, something that we've heard, produces a physical reaction in the body. And it also produces a mental reaction. The pleasant, the unpleasant, or the neutral, and the idea of what that thing is. As we continue to practice in our meditation, the whole process starts to reveal itself, not only in the meditation, but in daily life. We start to be aware of how the thing that we're encountering in this moment is coloured by what we're bringing from the past to this moment. And not only do we start to see that, we start to be able to recognise whether it's useful in the present moment, whether it's going to be to our advantage to act on this feeling, on this perception of the present moment. Like the little girl who loved to feed the ducks until she was told it was her chore to feed the ducks. When she considered that, she realised that she actually still liked to feed the ducks. It was just the idea of having to do it that she didn't like. And so she had to regain her affection for the ducks, her affinity with the ducks, by allowing that sense of a chore being something that was forced on her to subside, and to allow the perception of the ducks and feeding the ducks being something joyful to come to the foreground of her attention. To put attention on the aspect that was going to actually help her to be happy. And this is the next aspect of understanding working with perceptions, is that there are a multitude of perceptions accompanying any contact. And depending on where we put our attention, the things that we emphasize, we can always find positives or negatives in most experiences. For our own well-being, the skillful way is to emphasize what is positive, what is helpful, and to allow the negative perceptions, the unhelpful perceptions, to be there but not to predominate, so that they don't overwhelm the mind, they don't take away what could be a positive experience. As we become more familiar with perception and the way the mind works, we start to recognize how our desire, our craving, very often bends our perceptions, changes our perceptions, so that we are actually choosing aspects of things to focus on, but we weren't consciously aware that we were doing that. Depending on what we wanted, depending on what suits us, we are already doing that filtering out and allowing the things we don't like to fade away, and only choosing those things that we want to focus on. So, for example, if we overeat, if we like food that's not good for us, if we have a medical condition that is affected by what we eat, it's very easy to look at the food and see all the good things about it. To smell it, we like the smell. To remember how we liked this last time. To imagine how delicious it's going to taste. And to put it into our mouth and savour the taste. And forget about the fact that we know that this food is not good for us, or that the quantity of the food is not good for us, or to any of the aspects of that food which aren't useful for us, to recognize that it's not a skillful thing to eat it, or to eat so much of it, or to eat it so often. So we start to see how our perceptions are affected by our desires. And so when we realize that we're already bending our perceptions to suit what we like and what we don't like, what we want and what we don't want, then again it's a matter of becoming consciously aware of it. And in this path of practice, we're trying to become not only consciously aware of the process, but of the results of the process. Is this for my benefit? Is this for my well-being? Does this actually bring me peace and happiness? So in learning to manipulate perceptions, we're only really becoming consciously aware of something that we're doing already, but unconsciously. We're not aware that this is happening and that it is affecting our behaviour, affecting our choices, allowing unskillful choices to continue and making it difficult for us to adopt behaviours which lead us to more peace and more happiness. As I said, when we practice meditation, we become more aware of this process and we start to see which responses are coming up again and again, and then we start to be able to observe the results of those reactions, the results of this process. And part of this path is to help us to train our speech and our behaviour to be less harmful to ourselves and others, to help us to discern where we need to change so that we can be kinder to ourselves and kinder to others. So with the five precepts, learning to restrain our harsh speech, our dishonest speech, learning to refrain from taking what is not given. All of these precepts, guidelines for living that we become aware of through this path of practice, are ways of giving us something to hang our reactions around. They give us a focal point. If we know that we are unskillful in our behaviour around food, for example, and we become aware of the fact that we are relating to it in an unskillful way, then we might take up the precept about not harming ourselves or harming others, and use that precept to start to limit how much we eat of that particular food or how often we indulge in that particular food. And then we can generalize that to not only food but all kinds of other behaviors which are unskillful and unhelpful. Just by using that one precept, it can really encourage us to take another look at what we're doing. Through this process of meditation the mind starts to slow down, the process starts to become easier to see, and then the results of the process become easier to see, and we can take that wisdom into our daily life and make changes in the areas of our life that bring us suffering. Understanding perception is a very powerful tool in bringing about the changes that we wish to make in our own life, in our own mind, and also helping us to develop the kind of relationships with us, other people, and also with this world that lead to more harmony, more positive relationships for ourselves and for them as well. So I encourage you to reflect on this teaching and to see whether, going back to the meditation, your attitude towards the breath, if you can play around with that, if you can modify it, if that will help you to develop a relationship with the breath that allows you to stay focused on it and allows you to go further in your meditation practice. So may this teaching be of benefit to all of you, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. Does anyone have any questions or comments? For kidding ourselves. Yeah, for using the guidelines, for using it in a beneficial way, that's something we have to keep asking ourselves, because say we've got someone in the office that we don't get on with, and our perception of that person is that they're a pain and that they're trouble and they're out to get us and they're better to be avoided and all of those things. And we may have grounds for developing that perception of them. So whenever we see them, we can feel ourselves shrinking and feeling like we have to be on guard. So we become aware of our reactions, and we become aware of our perception of this person as trouble. And we recognize in that reaction, our reaction, that being on the defensive all the time doesn't really isn't conducive to perhaps working more positively with that person. If they're there and you've got to work with them, it may be actually detracting from our own peace of mind and our own ability to do our work well, or to feel comfortable to bring up suggestions about things or whatever. So we can modify our perception about that person once we realise that we're just automatically always seeing them as being trouble, and maybe start to see some of the positives about them, or actually look for some positives in them. And that may take some work. And in doing that, we are engendering a more helpful frame of mind for ourselves by focusing on positives rather than negatives. But we may also come to the conclusion that this person is in fact dangerous, or someone that we have to be careful of. But because we're no longer just automatically on the defensive, we are able to work more from our own space rather than letting that person dictate to us the ground on which we're working. So we look at the person's positives, we try to speak to the positives, work with the positives, but we don't bend our perception to the point where we unrealistically make them into an ally when they may not be. So we're trying to keep the middle ground. It's not a matter of just fooling ourselves and making something that's black into white just because we're trying to be nice. We're trying to be realistic as well. But waking up to the perceptions that we're having and how they're affecting us is a very important strategy for dealing with, say, a difficult person. Thing is, mostly we're not aware of our perceptions, and so it's the first stage is to wake up to the conditioning that's already present and that's already affecting us as we go through our daily life. So if there are no more questions, I'll hand over to Sol. The question is, how would you handle a situation where you're aware that someone has the wrong perception about you? Would you tell them? Right. Yes. So I think it's the Buddha's instructions in this matter are, if it's helpful to find the right time, and to find the right time means when you feel quite calm within yourself, when you feel that you can speak from a space of not blaming or accusing, but of clarity, of even-mindedness, of loving kindness. And then it's a matter of questioning, is the right time now? From my stand, is that how I'm feeling? Is the other person able to hear what I've got to say? So the right time means, is it a time that the other person can receive what I've got to say? And then if it's beneficial, the Buddha said, yes, go ahead and say it. So sometimes we have to ask ourselves, is this really going to be beneficial? Is it something that is going to be helpful for both parties or for one party? And then often the way that we say it and choosing the right time gives it the best possibility of being beneficial.